From Yacoub Tahwahi and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iranians hold nationwide rallies to condemn U.S. policies on the 43rd anniversary of the U.S. embassy takeover in Tehran. Iran slams inexcusable silence of the U.N. Security Council after deadly terrorist attack in the country's southern city of Shiraz. Also, the U.S. announces $400 million in additional military aid to Ukraine, bringing Biden administration's total commitment to Kiev to $19 billion. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. Iranians have taken part in nationwide rallies to mark National Student Day, which is the anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979. The day is also dubbed the National Day Against Global Arrogance. Gisumi Ahmadi tells us more.
In more than 900 cities nationwide, Iranians from all walks of life took to the streets on Friday, November the 4th, to mark National Students Day, the anniversary of the U.S. Embassy takeover, which is also called the National Day Against Global Arrogance. In the capital, Tehran, masses gathered in the streets leading to the building that used to be the U.S. Embassy in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. They chanted slogans expressing their anger and frustration with U.S. hostile policies towards the Islamic Republic of Iran.
We have come here to show our support for our leader in the face of enemies of our country, including the U.S.
Our presence today shows the U.S. that the nation is vigilant and we will not bow down to U.S. plots.
Considering the recent riots, it was even more important for me to take part in the rally this year. We have to show to the world that we love Iran and we support the Islamic Republic.
We are here, and it's literally we're coming onto the streets 43 years. You cannot find any more democratic country than Iran. What's the turnout of elections in Europe, in the West? There's supposed to be like the civilization and democracy, land of democracy. What's the turnout of their election? Look at all these people. These are coming by themselves.
Every year on the 13th day of the Iranian month of Aban, the Iranian nation, particularly students, hold rallies across the country to mark Students' Day. But this year's rallies come amid violent foreign-backed riots in the country, which have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces.
What's significant about this year's 13th of Aban, or Students' Day demonstrations, is the fact that the younger generation taking part in masses to send their message to the world, in particular, many young ladies taking part in this year's demonstration.
The U.S. should know that we have chosen to wear our hijab, and no one can force us to take it off.
Our hijab is a symbol of our religion and our faith. Our country is an Islamic country, and this is the way we choose to live.
In a statement, the demonstrators pledged allegiance to the Islamic Republic and the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. They also called on authorities to address people's legitimate demands and also draw a line between peaceful protesters and rioters. Kisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Iran's president has slammed his U.S. counterpart for supporting the recent riots in Iran and vowing that Washington will free the country. Ebrahim Raisi says Iran was freed 40 years ago in a reference to the Islamic Revolution of 1979.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
Raisi told a rally in Tehran to mark the National Day against global arrogance that the Iranian people are resolute and will never allow the U.S. to achieve its, quote, satanic goals. The president says the U.S. has been involved in over 300 wars and 62 coups across the world under the pretext of liberating nations. He says despite all that, Washington keeps trying to portray itself as a supporter of human rights. Iran is censuring the UN Security Council over its failure to condemn the recent terror attack in the country's southern city of Shiraz. In a letter to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the Security Council has been inexcusably silent on the Daesh-claimed attack. The foreign minister says the council's silence shows some of its members continue to categorize terrorists into good and bad ones. Amir Abdullahian says such behavior, when coupled with discriminatory and irresponsible actions, make it more difficult for the Council to effectively carry out its mandate in combating international terrorism. The terror operation in the city of Shiraz targeted pilgrims in a shrine, killing over a dozen people, including children. The U.S. is stepping up its military aid to Ukraine by $400 million despite warnings by Russia. The U.S. will pay for the overhaul of T-72 tanks and for missiles used in Hawk air defense systems. There's also funding to buy hundreds of tactical unmanned aerial systems and dozens of armored boats. The U.S. has been the biggest sponsor of the Ukrainian military since the beginning of its war with Russia in February. The value of the U.S. military aid now stands at close to $19 billion. Moscow has repeatedly warned against the delivery of foreign military aid to Ukraine, saying it only prolongs the conflict. Our correspondent Johnny Miller is with us from Sevastopol. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. First, let's just hear from you the latest update on the war in Ukraine.
Well, fighting continues along hundreds of kilometers in Ukraine, from Kherson in the south, not far to the north of where I am now, right up to the north of the Donbass. Russia is making some small gains in the Donbass. Its primary target there is to capture the city of Slavyansk, which is very important in order to secure water to Donetsk. Of course, Donetsk is very much the capital of the Donbass region, while Ukrainian aims are to take Kherson. There has been disputing claims of whether Russia will hold on to Kherson. Many say Russia has turned Kherson into a fortress. Others say Russia may be about to withdraw. So very much eyes on Kherson at the moment, of whether Ukraine is able to take back that strategically vital city.
Johnny, the U.S. has announced additional $400 million in military aid to Ukraine, putting its total at about $19 billion. Can you tell us more about that and if there's been any reaction from Moscow?
Yes, well, this is just another one of these aid announcements to Ukraine. There's been many in the recent months. There's some speculation of whether it might be done now before the U.S. midterm elections on Tuesday. Some Republicans have stated that they might be less willing to support Ukraine, or maybe this is just another round of aid packages to the country. Ukraine, of course, relying on NATO weapons and funding. Frankly, if that funding or these weapons stopped, Ukraine would be forced to the negotiating table. Britain, for example, giving over 6% of its military budget to Ukraine. Some Eastern European countries giving as much as 40% of their military budget to Ukraine. So this is very much a fight between Russia and NATO. And while NATO continue to arm Ukraine, it's Ukraine that is paying for this war in blood. Tens of thousands, probably over 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers have already been killed in this war. Much has been made of Russia's partial mobilization recently, but Ukraine is already on its third or fourth wave of mobilization. So very much at the moment, Ukraine giving Ukraine the weapons and Ukraine paying for it in blood.
Any reaction from Moscow so far?
Moscow continues to warn of the same, of potential escalation. The United States has also said that there is now U.S. troops in Ukraine. We've known that for a long time. They say that they're training Ukrainian soldiers. But there's also a lot of speculation that particularly British and American military advisors may well be helping to coordinate Ukraine's fight on the battlefield. So this war continues, and Russia indeed continues to warn that this war is in danger of spilling from a regional war into a global war. And of course, a war between Russia and the United and NATO could be catastrophic for the whole world.
Johnny, thank you so much. Stay safe. Johnny Miller, correspondent in Sevastopol. Moving on, Moody's has changed the Italian banking outlook from stable to negative. This as growth prospects in the country have been downgraded by national and international statistical agencies and institutions. Max Civili reports from Rome.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat, Employers Association Confindustria, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency Istat has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Milk, bread, pasta. All these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni traveled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
British Muslim student groups are threatening a boycott of a major student union after the sacking of its female Muslim president. Shaima Dalali faced an investigation into alleged anti-Semitic comments posted in her Facebook post no longer after her election to the position in March 2022. Robert Carter reports from British capital London.
An Islamophobia scandal now threatens a British student union following anger over the sacking of its female Muslim president amid allegations of anti-Semitism. Shaima Dalali was elected president of the National Union of Students in March. Dalali was initially hailed for being the first ever black Muslim female to take up the post. However, she was suspended from the role in July amid an investigation into anti-Israel comments she made up to 10 years prior to her election, including a 2012 tweet in which Ms. Dalali wrote, "Khayber Khayber, O Jews, Mohammed's army will return to Gaza," a tweet she has since apologized for. An NUS statement on the decision said,
"Following the independent King's College-led investigation into allegations of anti-Semitism, specifically into the then president-elect under the NUS Code of Conduct, an independent panel has found that significant breaches of NUS's policies have taken place. As per this finding, we have terminated the president's contract."
Dalali expressed further fury at the news of her sacking after she discovered it on Twitter. Shared by a pro-Israel newspaper who may have been leaked the story prior to the NUS updating Mrs. Dalali. In response, Dalali has vowed to fight the outcome via a pending legal challenge alleging discriminatory treatment. Mrs. Dalali's sacking has sparked furious anger across the British Muslim community, who believe this is gross censorship of pro-Palestine activism.
Anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is like comparing apples and oranges. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Jewish faith. Actually, it's the weaponization of the Jewish faith that we are seeing. What we are talking is a colonization enterprise. That is, the whole existence of the Israeli regime is a colonization enterprise. It's clear that the whole issue is to criminalize pro-Palestinian sentiment, which actually shows you how effective pro-Palestinian sentiment is.
Things could get very ugly for the NUS as Muslim student bodies are threatening a boycott and Dalali plans her fight back. The NUS has previously prided itself on being an inclusive environment for all and an advocate of free speech. However, they now have to prove that that is indeed the case amid racism and Islamophobia accusations thrown their way by the former president, Robert Carter, London.
South Korea and the U.S. continue their largest ever joint air drills in a show of strength as tensions escalate with North Korea. A South Korean official says a U.S. B-1B strategic bomber will participate on the last day of the war games. The drills were due to end on Friday but extended to another day. The U.S. and South Korea say the move was in response to continued provocations by the North. Pyongyang has conducted a flurry of missile launches and artillery fire in recent days. One missile landed near the South's territorial waters. South Korean officials also claimed the North had mobilized its 80 fighter jets. Pyongyang is strongly critical of the U.S.-South Korea drills, which it considers as rehearsals for an invasion. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. We'll be right back.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Farewell, O innocent Lady of Qom. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, Salam and condolences to you on a doleful day of the departure from the world of our innocent Lady of Qom, Hazrat Ma'sume al-Fatime, peace upon her. The Immaculate Daughter of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Stay with us for an exclusive feature. Today, the 10th of Rabiul Akhir, is the sad anniversary of the departure from the mortal world of our innocent lady of Qom. According to other narrations, her ascent to the heavens was on the 12th of this same month. Whatever the exact date of the Almighty's decision to recall her to his presence, a decision that transformed Qom into a gateway of paradise, the people of this Iranian city have ever since been commemorating these 3 days as Ayyamiye Ma'sumiye in honor of the venerable daughter of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, the consanguineous sister of Imam Reza, peace upon him, needs no introduction. The shrine of Fatima al-Ma'sumah, peace upon her, is the rendezvous of pilgrims from all over Iran and from throughout the world. Born in Medina in 173 AH, corresponding to 790 AD, she was named in honor of her great ancestress, the noblest lady of all times, the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra, peace upon her. She was 10 years old when her father was martyred through a dose of poison in the prison of Baghdad on the orders of the tyrant Harun al-Rashid, the self-styled caliph of the usurper Abbasid regime. Thereupon, her consanguineous brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, assumed charge of her upbringing. She grew up into the most virtuous lady of her times, demonstrating her God-given knowledge even as a girl of less than 10 years old, when, in the absence of her father, she provided the correct, logical, and satisfactory answers to a set of jurisprudential queries posed by a group of Iranian pilgrims from Khorasan, who had called upon the threshold of the Ahlul Bayt in Medina. When this group chanced to meet Imam Kazem, peace upon him, on their way back and showed him the answers provided by his little daughter, he said, Fedaha Abuha, which means, may her father be her ransom. This excellent lady did not marry as no man of her age was worthy of her hand. In addition to the political conditions of the time, that did not permit any qualified suitor from approaching the persecuted family of the Prophet. In 200 AH, when the crafty Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun forced Imam Reza, peace upon him, to leave Medina and come to his capital in distant Marvin Khorasan, the noble lady became distraught on separation from her brother. When news reached her from northeastern Iran of the respect, although outward, shown to her brother, who was deceitfully declared her apparent by Ma'mun, the sister, along with some of her brothers, decided to journey to Khorasan. After an arduous journey lasting several months, when her entourage reached the outskirts of the city of Save, 128 kilometers west of modern-day Tehran, it was attacked by agents of the Abbasid regime. In the ensuing battle, several members of her entourage, including her brothers, were martyred, making the lady to change direction of the caravan towards Qom, which was the center of the followers of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt in Iran. Thank you. On hearing of her approach, the people enthusiastically came out and welcomed her. She was shown great respect, and during her 17-day sojourn in the city, she enlightened the people on many issues, including the merits of the infallible imams and hadith from the prophets on their virtues. The fatigue of the journey and the injuries she had suffered as a result of the skirmish near Save, this blessed lady answered the divine call and left for her heavenly abode. The people of Qom turned out in large numbers for her funeral and laid her to rest in the orchard beside the local stream, which over the centuries has grown into the sprawling mausoleum in the midst of which is her golden-domed shrine. When Imam Reza, peace upon him, learned of her death, he miraculously arrived from Khorasan and gave burial to his virtuous sister. The epithet Ma'thume, meaning innocent, was given to her by her brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him. It is worth noting that this was awarded to her posthumously, which disproves the erroneous view of her sudden death on learning of the martyrdom of Imam Reza, peace upon him. The eighth Imam who performed her funeral prayer had remarked, "Whoever visits Ma'sume in Qom is like the one who has visited me." The ziyarat, or standard form of salutation for this noble lady, which has been recorded on the authority of Imam Reza, peace upon him, contains the phrase, "O Fatime, intercede for me on the day of judgment so that I enter heaven, for indeed you have a great status in the sight of Allah." As for her other famous epithet, Karime Ahl Bayt, which means the munificent lady of the Prophet's progeny, it was given to her by her great-grandfather, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, in a dream to Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Mar'ashi Najafi, father of the famous bibliophile Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Shahabuddin Mar'ashi. When the elder Mar'ashi Najafi supplicated for 40 consecutive nights with the intention of being blessed with the sight of the location of the grave of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, he had a dream after completion of the prayers. He saw himself in the presence of Imam Baqir, peace upon him, who said to him, "Tidings to you of the Karime Ahl Bayt." He thought the term munificent lady of the Ahl al-Bayt meant the Prophet's immaculate daughter, at which the fifth Imam remarked, "I mean the holy grave of Fatima al-Ma'sume, peace upon her, in Qom." The Imam added, "It is Allah's will that the location of the holy grave of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, peace upon her, be hidden from everyone." On waking up, the Ayatollah understood and informed his family that all the honor and grandeur reserved for the concealed grave of the Prophet's immaculate daughter has been accorded to the tomb of Lady Fatime al-Ma'sume, peace upon her. He, however, soon passed away in Holy Najaf, but his illustrious son, Grand Ayatollah Shahabuddin Mar'ashi Najafi, migrated to Iran and often cited that one of the reasons for his settling in Qom was the dream of his father. For over 60 years, every morning, the late Ayatollah Shahabuddin Mar'ashi used to be the first person to perform the pilgrimage at the shrine of this noble lady. He would wait outside her shrine for the doors to be opened. Even during his final illness, before his death, he requested to be carried to the shrine in order to perform her pilgrimage. Now we understand the prediction of her grandfather, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. A lady from my offspring, whose name will be Fatima, daughter of Musa, will be buried in Qom. On the Day of Judgment, she will intercede for my Shia to enter heaven.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Dr. Syed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, a revolutionary fighter. On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks, including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system, is among the first orders of Iran's king, who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replaced with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of a General Office of Writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Mohammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, "The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950, when Ahmad Qavam made his famous bullish speech, and I heard it on the radio. I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home." The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, no matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them. The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. The mid-50s, and Sayyid Mohammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allama Tabatabai's classes for 5 years, and Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government casts clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea. teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the Religion and Knowledge School. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the Religion and Knowledge School in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayyid Muhammad Dr. Beheshti, a doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesbah Yazdi, and others to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brugerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brugerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brugerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brugerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. Savak doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, Savak documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's Religion and Knowledge School. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. Savak has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores Savak's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, Savak's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifa's military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Savak's blacklist because of the Mutalifa, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man, with so much ability, to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Kazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work.
the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the university students' union to be independent, he still speaks quite frankly during the last session. "Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much." The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti, Bahonar, and Golzadeh Ghafouri. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous, but he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, "I preferred this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life." Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. "My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a book that has photos of the Shah and his family." On March 9, 1971, the teacher starts his new work. Beheshti prepares the entirety of the lesson, and Bahonar and Golzadeh are in charge of preparing the content. At times, they ask Mr. Mutahiri for help. The prepared content gets its final approval by the group, and in the end, they give samples of the book to nearly 1,000 people so they could read them and give them their opinions. From university professors to students. The doctor does the job perfectly and with high quality. He even becomes adamant that the photos in the book are in color. The doctor believes the students must definitely see the red flag of Imam Hussein. Slowly, the books reach the students, not only millions of secondary and high school students across the country, but also their teachers become familiar with a new view and outlook of Islam. Later on, authors of the group hold seminars for teachers in different cities. Beheshti himself teaches the entire book to the teachers once. During these sessions,
He's sensitive to know how religion teachers react while reading the textbook, what their opinion and criticism of the textbook is. What he does causes the training of a large number of educated individuals of this influential class. Beheshi says, "We were always worried, not out of fear that they'd arrest us and put us in prison or things like that. We were never scared of these things. We were worried that the work we were doing would be left unfinished. With God's help and relying on a well-planned method, we were successful in preparing the last of the books. Exactly after we'd sent that last book for publication, the hellish organization of the Shah found out what we'd done." On April 1, 1974, Salvak writes in one of his documents, "Beheshi's employment in sensitive but secondary positions of the Ministry of Education is not favorable because of his past political activities." This happens exactly a few days after the female minister's appreciation of Mr. Beheshi for his total seriousness and interest in Iran's school books organization. But it's too late. The books have been published, and millions of students across the country have access to them. Savak asks the Ministry of Education for explanations a number of times. But the revolutionary voices of protest can now be heard from every corner of the country. The years from 1970 to 1976 are six influential years of the presence of the teacher in the systemization of the minds of the students of Iran. Dr. Sayed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, born in Isfahan, a student of Qom's seminary school and a graduate of University of Tehran, known back then as Maqul and Mangul College, a talented genius and a revolutionary fighter. A cleric who's a teacher who started his struggle against Taghut from small classrooms in a school in Qom, and with effort and hard work, made it to the highest positions of influence in the Ministry of Education. And in the end, he was able to train a generation whose freedom-seeking and fighting injustice spirit was heard by the entire world, the huge revolution in Iran.
Limelight. With friends like the U.S., who needs enemies? To realize its own geopolitical goals, the U.S. is never shy to sacrifice its allies, with Europe facing an unprecedented economic hardship, partly due to joining Washington's sanction endeavors. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, citing sources, a Bloomberg report claimed recently that Washington suggested the European Union draw upon lessons from the export control regime they are using to punish Russia or target Russia. The Joe Biden administration is exploring using some of the same information sharing and enforcement coordination to strengthen its export controls on China. The people familiar with the matter told Bloomberg. Regarding collaboration to restrict exports to Moscow, Washington has clearly benefited a lot since the Russia-Ukraine conflict began. This has seemingly emboldened the U.S. to persuade Europe to take the same approach against Russia. But this time, it is clearly playing the wrong game. The great mutual dependence between China and Europe is much greater than their differences, and judging from the size of China's economy, its ability to resist suppression, and the resilience of China-EU economic ties, it is difficult for the U.S. to push the EU to use economic instruments irrationally against China, said Chinese observers. Obviously, the EU understands this better than the U.S., and that's why Europe showed no interest in applying export controls on Russia to China, as Bloomberg reported. Meanwhile, Saloni Sharma, spokeswoman for the U.S. National Security Council, refuted the report, stating that the U.S. is not considering extending the Russia export controls to China, nor have they raised doing so with the Europeans. Nevertheless, with its history of abusing export controls considered,